And now please open your Bibles to Hebrews chapter 8, verses 1 through 5 for the text of our lesson this morning. Hebrews chapter 8, verses 1 through 5. For if he were on earth, Now this is the main point of the things we're saying. We have such a high priest who is seated at the right hand of the throne of the majesty in the heavens, a minister of the sanctuary and of the true tabernacle which the Lord erected and not man. For every high priest is appointed to offer both gifts and sacrifices. Therefore, it is necessary that this one also have something to offer. For if he were on earth, he would not be a priest, since the priests offer the gifts according to the law, who serve the copy and shadow of heavenly things, as Moses was divinely instructed when he was about to make the tabernacle. For he said, "See that you make all things according to the pattern shown to you on the mountain." There are those who believe that the Lord has given no pattern for His church. But we have found last week, last Sunday morning, we began a study of the organization of the church, and we looked at the universal church. Remember that the word church is used in three ways in the New Testament. First, it's used of the universal body of the saved, and obviously there's just one of that. That is the church Jesus built that He describes or that He mentions in Matthew chapter 16, verse 18. And then the second sense in which the word church is used is of the local congregation. And we gave, for example, 1 Corinthians chapter 1, verse 2. And then the assembly of the local church. And we gave 1 Corinthians 11, verse 18 as an example of that. Now, last week we looked at the universal church, the universal body of the saved. And there is no earthly organization for the universal church. Now, by organization, remember again, and I'm reminding us some things we studied before that we need to know as we get into this lesson. We used three things that go together to make up the term organization. There is oversight. Somebody or some people have to make decisions. There are pooled resources. There are resources, whether it be a treasure or whether it even be the abilities of the people, that are done together. There's oversight, pooled resources, and a common work to be done. Something that is done together, something that is done as a group rather than being done individually. Now, as an example of that difference, let's go to 1 Timothy chapter 5, verse 16. And what we're going to do today, now that we've looked at the universal church and see that it has no earthly organization, see that the New Testament does not even authorize such a thing as a denomination or a sect, now we're going to look at the local church and see what organization it has. And the first question we will put before us is, well, is it organized? Does it have organization? Does it act as a group or only individual? There was a group of people some years ago. Charles Holt was the leader of this group. He's a preacher of the generation of my dad. And he taught that there's no such thing as the local church apart from the assembly, that it does not act together as a unit. But I don't see how in the world those people can harmonize that doctrine with 1 Timothy chapter 5, verse 16. In 1 Timothy chapter 5, verse 16, the Apostle Paul says, "If any believing man or woman has widows, let them relieve them, and do not let the church be burdened, that it may relieve those who are really widows." I've given this example before, so I'll give it quickly. My mother was a widow for 12 years. My father passed away in 1987. She passed away in 1999. Now, the last 4 years of her life, I lived in northern New York. She lived in Little Rock. And so it was about 1,300 miles between the two of us. Just suppose that she were to call me and say, "Keith, I don't have any food in the pantry. I just don't have any money to go buy some food. I'm going to starve to death if I don't have some help here. I need some help. Now, before I say this, I want you to understand, first of all, that did not happen to her. And second of all, I would not let that happen to her. And I would not do what I'm going to describe here. So I don't want anybody wanting to lynch me during this lesson or shortly thereafter. And so I would not do what I'm going to give as just a what-if situation. What if I were to say, well, Mother, I'm way up here in northern New York. I'm 1,300 miles away. You know, we can barely pay our bills. Why don't you go to the Brethren there north of Little Rock? She was a member of the congregation north of Little Rock. Why don't you go to the Brethren there and see if they can help you out? Now, if you knew that about me, would you want me to come and work with you as a preacher and an elder of this congregation? Why, no, I'd be worse than an unbeliever. Unbelievers out in the world take care of their own kin folks. Why, an unbeliever out in the world knows that he has an obligation to his own widowed mother. And Paul says in 1 Timothy chapter 5, I believe about verse 8, that a man that won't care for his own, especially his own house, he's denied the faith and is worse than an unbeliever, worse than an infidel. No, it was my obligation, my brother who lived in Little Rock, but the fact he lived in Little Rock didn't make her his obligation any more than she was my obligation while she was a widow. And thus, if you have a widowed mother, she's your obligation. If you have a widowed grandmother, she's your obligation. If you have kin folks that are kin to you and they're helpless, they're your obligation. But there are those who are called in the New King James translation really widows. The Old King James says widows indeed. And by the way, that word widow means one who is desolate. That's the definition of that word widow. But we know it means a woman whose husband has died. But the literal root meaning of that word is one who is desolate. And that's the reason that Paul talked about one who is really desolate. One who is desolate indeed. She has no one to care for her. And there are other qualifications given there. If you'll read in 1 Timothy chapter 5, beginning about verse 3 and going on down through the chapter, there are qualifications that a woman has to meet before she can be classified as a widow indeed and become a permanent charge of the church. Those widows indeed are permanent charges of the church, and the church has the obligation to care for them. And so the Apostle Paul in 1 Timothy chapter 5 makes a very clear distinction between our personal obligations, our one-on-one obligations, and the obligations that the church as a group, as an entity has. And those two are not the same. They must not be confused. It says, let not the church be charged that it may relieve those who are really widows. Those are widows indeed. And so the church does function as a group. It functions as an entity where we all function together. We might even say in a corporate sense, and I don't mean a corporation, of course, but in a group sense rather than as individuals. And the church does have organization. God has given His church organization. When the local church is mature, then it is to have officers. All the officers of the local church are given in one verse, Philippians chapter 1, verse 1. What is really amazing about this, and I think this is the reason people of the world are not satisfied with this, how simple the organization is that God has given His church. The universal church has none. The local church is the only organized sense of God's people, how God's people work together as His people in an organized way. The local church, that's it. There's no other organization. God has given His people functioning in the spiritual realm as His people. In other words, functioning as the church. And there are only two offices in the local church. In Philippians chapter 1, verse 1, Paul and Timothy, bondservants of Jesus Christ, to all the saints in Christ Jesus. Now that's all the members. And by the way, that word members is a good Bible word used in 1 Corinthians chapter 12, for example, to describe those who are members of the church, who compose the church. With the saints, that he says, with the bishops and the deacon. And I'm going to stop and talk about that for just a moment. Don't have time to belabor this point. But first of all, that word bishop just means overseer. And notice there's the plurality. And every time There is, whether it's a command or an example in the New Testament, of a local church having those men, there's always a plurality, never just one. And we're going to see when we go to 1 Peter chapter 5 shortly, that word bishop or overseer is used interchangeably with some other words that describe other aspects of the office. But we'll just stick with the verse that we have. In this verse, it's called bishops. And so there's a plurality in the local church at Philippi. So there's more than one in that local church. And that word means overseers, which implies that they're the ones who make the decisions. They rule. And that is exactly what Paul says concerning their function in 1 Timothy chapter 5. But then it says, with the deacons. And the word deacon just means servant. It's the Greek word diakonos, which in the King James, the New King James, does not really translate. It's what's called transliterated. They took the Greek word and gave it English letters. And so diakonos was changed to deacons. The word just means a minister or a servant. And that's all. That's all the organization God has given His church. There are the overseers who rule. There are the deacons, the servants who serve. That's what they do. They serve. And then there's the saints, the members, who work together. That's the simple organization, the only organization on this earth that God has given His church. Now, what about the preacher? What about evangelists? Well, I am a preacher or an evangelist wherever I go. In fact, I'll use myself as an example on this. I am an elder or an overseer only in this local congregation. Joe and I make the decisions. Now, we listen to the members of the church. We want to know what your thoughts are and what you desire. But there's somebody has to make the decisions, and that's Joe. And I make those decisions as the elders, the bishops, the overseers of the local church. And so only in this local church am I an overseer, am I an elder. No other church. I don't have any say whatsoever in the affairs of any other congregation or any part of the work of any other congregation or of any organization other than the Highway 5 South Church of Christ in Mountain Home, Arkansas. And we'll get more about down to that in just shortly. But as a preacher, as an evangelist, I'm a preacher or an evangelist wherever I go. That's not an office in the local church. When I was down in Nacogdoches, Texas last week, I was a preacher, an evangelist down there. When Sandy and I go first to New York, then to London, then to Uganda, then to Kenya during March and April, I'll be an evangelist in those places. I'll be there preaching the gospel. And so wherever an evangelist goes, he's an evangelist. That's not an office in the local church. But the local church may have fellowship, share in their work with one or more evangelists. In Philippians chapter 4, verses 15 and 16. Now, you see in Philippians 1:1, you saw the organization of the church. In Philippians 4, you see the relationship that the local church has with a preacher or an evangelist. A preacher is simply one who announces things. The word evangelist is just a little bit more specialized, means somebody who announces good news. He's a bearer of good news. And that's my job as a preacher. In Philippians 4:15 and 16, now you Philippians know also that in the beginning of the gospel when I departed from Macedonia, that is in the beginning of when they were Christians, and see Philippi's in Macedonia, and even after Paul had started in Acts chapter 16, the congregation of Philippi, as he was leaving Macedonia, that a Roman province of Macedonia, he said, even in Macedonia, you shared once again with my necessities. And you send aid once and again with my necessities. He says, no church shared with me concerning giving and receiving, but you only. That phrase, giving and receiving, is a Greek idiom, a way of saying financial affairs. We'd say receive the things that are receivable and the things that we owe, you know, the debts and so forth. And it's just it's a statement about financial affairs. No other church had any financial relationship with Paul, is what he's saying, except the church of Philippi. They sent repeatedly to him to help him. See, he was not in Philippi. He'd left Philippi. But they were sharing in His work. And that's that Greek word for fellowship, koinonia, fellowship. They were sharing in His work by sharing with Him financially, helping Him in His finances. And so a congregation can share with one preacher, or a congregation can share with several preachers, or several congregations can share with one preacher in His work, financially I'm talking about, in His work of preaching the gospel. And so an evangelist is that wherever he goes. And the congregation, every local church, has a quality that is very, very important when it comes to the organization of the church. This quality that we're going to talk about right now is the safeguard that the Lord uses to keep His church from becoming a denomination. And when this safeguard was broken down, beginning in the late 1st century, early 2nd century, according to historians, eventually the breaking down of that safeguard led to the formation in the West of the Roman Catholic Church and in the East of the Orthodox Church. Well, what is this quality of the local church that safeguards it from going in and becoming a denomination, from going into a falling away and apostasy? Well, it's stated in 1 Peter chapter 5, verses 1 and 2. The word is not used that I'm going to use, but the principle is there taught. The elders who are among you, I exhort. I whom, now notice he uses that word elder. That just means an older man. I who am a fellow elder and a witness of the sufferings of Christ and also a partaker of the glory that shall be revealed, shepherd the flock of God. Now that word shepherd is a verb. It's an action word. But it's the verb form of the noun, the naming word, which means a shepherd or a pastor. All right, so elders and pastors or shepherds are the same thing. All right, now notice what he says, serving as overseers, and that's that word bishop. All right, so there's three words, bishop, which means overseer, elder, which means older man, and shepherd or pastor, that all describe one and the same office in the local church, and there's always a plurality. You cannot have just one. It is wrong to have just one man as the pastor of the local church. That's a denominational concept which violates the New Testament. There's always more than one. It doesn't say how many, as long as it's more than one. But where do these elders rule? Where is their oversight? He says, shepherd the flock of God, notice carefully, which is among you, or where you are, serving as overseers, not by compulsion, but willingly, not for dishonest gain, but eagerly. Now, where do they have oversight? The church where they are. The elders of this local church have the oversight of this local church, and that's it. And the elders of any local church, now listen carefully, please. I don't care if that local church has 40 members or so, that would be a description of this congregation, or 500 members or so. Or, well, let's take the congregation down in Nacogdoches where I preached last week. Congregation of about 250 members. And they have several elders. I'm not sure exactly how many. I know they have several. But whether it's a congregation of 250 members or a congregation of 40 members or a congregation of 500 members, the elders of that congregation have the oversight of and only of the congregation where they are members. They don't have the oversight of any part of the work of any other congregation. Now that concept is usually called autonomy. Now that's kind of a fancy word. That means self-government. And that means the decisions for that local church, for every part of the work of that local church, are made within that local church. Now if there's a congregation over in Jinja, Uganda, and there is, and they don't have elders yet, but nonetheless, I cannot, now I'll be over there, the Lord willing, in Jinja, Uganda, the last week of March, Sandy be with me, and we will be teaching over there, and I will be preaching over there, and I'll be working with that congregation in Jinja, Uganda, but I have no authority whatsoever to make any decisions for any part of the work of that congregation in Jinja, Uganda. The decisions that are made must be made within that local church, even without elders. Then the men of that congregation will have to, 1 Corinthians chapter 11, verse 3, the men of that congregation will have to make the decisions for that local church. That's autonomy. That's self-government, self-rule within each local church. And that is one of the basic concepts of church government, we might say, or of the organization of the church that safeguards the church against going into apostasy. Now, that does not mean that churches cannot cooperate. I have been accused of not believing in congregational cooperation. That's not true. I believe that congregations may cooperate with each other, but if you look at the examples and in the teaching of that's by way of statement or command in the New Testament that talks about cooperation between congregations, then you will see that the kind of cooperation that was done never sacrificed any of the autonomy, the self-government of each local church. I'm going to give you some examples of cooperation between congregations in the New Testament. And we'll see that in each case, no congregation gave up its own self-rule, its own self-government. First, look at Acts 11, verses 19 through 22. Then, now, those who were scattered after the persecution that arose over Stephen traveled as far as Phoenicia, Cyprus, and Antioch, preaching the word to no one but to the Jews only. But some of them were men from Cyprus and Cyrene, who when they had come to Antioch, spoke to the Hellenists, that is the Greeks, speaking, preaching the Lord Jesus. And the hand of the Lord was with them, and a great number believed and turned to the Lord. Now notice, here's something going on at Antioch. A lot of people believing, becoming Christians in Antioch. Now Antioch is way up north of the land of Canaan, where the church started in Jerusalem in the land of Palestine. But notice what happened. And Antioch is a great city up there, one of the three largest cities in the Roman Empire. Then news of these things came to the church, ears of the church in Jerusalem. Notice if the church had ears, that's talking to disperse, that's the members it's talking about there. News of these things came to the ears of the church in Jerusalem, and they sent out Barnabas to go as far as Antioch. Now, it is perfectly scriptural right to send teaching. Whether it's in the form of sending out a preacher, there are churches that are helping send me to Africa in March and April. And they're sending teaching over there in the form of a preacher going over there to teach them. But there's other ways you can send out teaching. For example, this church has a website. And we get requests for our Bible correspondence, of course, literally from all over the world. There's a map back there on the back of the auditorium, a map of the world. And Sandy's put pins in it to show you where right now people are taking the Bible correspondence course that we send out from here all over the world. And so we can send teaching anywhere. Now those local churches can determine whether or not they want to receive that teaching. They can determine whether or not they want that preacher to come and work with them. When I go to Nigeria, where there are mature congregations, the gospel's been there since 1948. I will email. I used to have to write a letter and wait for a month or so for get an answer back, or maybe more than a month to get an answer back. Now you can email, get an answer back the next day. And asked them, said, would you like me to come teach classes? And here's what I'd like to do. With the permission of the congregation, to the elders of the congregation, I'll come and teach classes for preachers there. And I'd like for preachers to come from other places for these classes. But I don't go unless they say, yes, you can come and work with this church. If they say, no, we don't want you, I don't go. It has to be a matter of each local church decides for itself what they're going to do. And so we can send out teaching anywhere, but local churches can decide whether or not they'll receive that teaching and pass it on to their members. Now then, when we look at the organization of the church, we can see that many congregations can support one preacher. 2 Corinthians chapter 11, verse 8, Paul told the brethren at Corinth, I robbed other churches, taking wages from them to do you service. Now, obviously, Paul did not literally rob those other churches. I believe what he's saying here is, I took the money from other churches from which they received no direct benefit. I wasn't teaching them, I was teaching you. So in essence, he was robbing them. Well, you know what? I rob other churches to help you in the preaching. There are other churches that help in my support to preach the gospel here in Mountain Home, Arkansas. I'm doing exactly what the Apostle Paul did, as he described in 2 Corinthians 11, verse 8, when he was preaching in Corinth. And churches cooperate that way. When churches send money to the same preacher or send help to the same preacher, they're cooperating in that preacher's work. And when I go to Africa, it's that way. Several churches will send money to help me go to Africa, and they are cooperating, but they're sending directly to the preacher, and each church makes its own decision by whom it will help and how much it will help him. Each church maintains its own autonomy, its independence. And it's also scriptural for a number of churches to send benevolent help to one congregation. In 1 Corinthians chapter 16, verses 1 through 4. Now concerning, this is 1 Corinthians 16, 1 through 4. Now concerning the collection for the saints, as I have given order to the churches of Galatia, so you must do also on the first day of the week, that each one of you lay something aside, storing up, as he may prosper, that there be no collections when I come. And when I come, whomever you approve by your letters, I will send to bear your gift to Jerusalem, and if it is fitting that I go also, they will go with me. Each church took its own contribution. Each church chose its own messenger, and each church sent by its own messenger down to the church in Jerusalem. Now, each of the local churches, their work was helping the church in Jerusalem because it was unable to relieve its own need. The church in Jerusalem, the elders of that church decided who within that local church was in need. And so each church decided its own work. There was independence, there was autonomy, but that is true congregational cooperation. There has been a drought. I actually think there's a change of climate in the nation of Zimbabwe in southern Africa. And I've been there and preached both in Bulawayo, the second largest city, and out in the bush in various congregations in Zimbabwe several years ago. And those brethren have been in danger of starvation. There's a lot of Christians in Zimbabwe, a lot of congregations, a lot of preachers. They've been in danger of starvation. And a number of congregations, various places, send funds to a friend of mine whose name is Newman Gupo. He lives in Bulawayo, Zimbabwe. And they send those funds to him as their messenger. And he takes those funds out into the bush. And he delivers those funds to the various, and he'll ask, well, how many are in the congregation are in need of relief or in danger of starvation? And he'll give them the funds. The congregations in America and some in South Africa and one in Bulawayo that sends the funds, they determine who they're going to send it by, they determine where the funds go, and the elders of each local church determine who within that congregation receive those funds. They cooperate, but each congregation maintains its autonomy, its independence, its self-governing nature. Even those congregations out in the bush where there's very little education, they are still autonomous. They still make their own decisions. So that is one of the basic principles. Local churches must not be bound together in any organizational ties that compromise their autonomy. Now, let me give some examples of some that historically over the last 200 years have messed brethren up in giving up at least some of their autonomy. The original reason that the Christian church and the Church of Christ split from each other back in the 19th century was the United Christian Missionary Society. It was organized in Cincinnati, Ohio in 1849. The first president of it was Alexander Campbell. Maybe you've heard of Alexander Campbell. When people accuse me of being a Campbellite and say that I follow Campbell, I said, no, if I'd been following Alexander Campbell, I'd be in the Christian church. He was the first president of the United Christian Missionary Society. They had an organization tying local churches together, making decisions for the local churches as to what they would do in the realm of evangelism. And in so doing, not only did they corrupt the organization of the church, they sacrificed their autonomy to that central organization. And that's the original reason for the division between the Church of Christ on the one hand and the Christian church on the other hand. There are now, the first thing listed on the chart is associations. I skipped right over that. Every Baptist pastor I know of says he believes in the autonomy of each local Baptist church, but the joint associations, and though whether and there's different associations that determines what kind of Baptist they are, and they do work through those associations, and the decisions that are made concerning what those associations do are made by the leadership of the association, not by the local church. They give up a part of their autonomy. And by the way, it turns them into a denomination, just like the missionary society turned the Christian church into a denomination. Back in the 1940s, a man by the name of N.B. Hardeman, president of Fried Hardeman College over in Tennessee, wanted churches to support Fried Hardeman College, but he couldn't get them to do that. G.C. Brewer had already tried that before in the 1930s. Brethren were not interested then. They didn't believe it was scriptural. I believe that they were right. N.B. Hardeman made an argument that swayed the majority of the brethren. And a number of churches, in fact, the majority of churches of Christ, started supporting colleges in the 1950s as the result of the argument that N.B. Hardeman made in the 1940s. He said, if it's scriptural to support the orphanage, it is also scriptural to support the college. Now listen to me carefully. He was 100% right. One is a human organization, and so is the other. One is an organization built by men with a board of directors, and so is the other. But the problem is, he believed they were both right, and the truth is, they're both wrong. It's wrong for the church to support any man-made organization of any kind from its treasury. When a church makes a contribution to anything, it's an expression of fellowship in Christ, and it is turning the decision-making power over to that organization. The orphanage, the board of directors, they decide how the children will be helped, what help they will be given. The board of directors of the college, they determine who's going to teach, what they're going to teach. In each case, the church is not only is it a corruption of the organization of the church is sacrificing its autonomy to an organization built by men. The only organization God has given for His church is the local church with its elders. Anything else is a corruption. Now, the sponsoring church, sure, they've got an eldership, but that eldership makes decisions not for just the church where they are, but for whatever congregations help in that work. And in so doing, they are those churches that send their funds to the sponsoring church, they are sacrificing their autonomy, their independence, their self-governing to that central congregation. All of that is in violation of 2 John verse 9. Whoever transgresses and does not abide in the doctrine of Christ does not have God. He who abides in the doctrine of Christ has both the Father and the Son. There's no authority for the church to sin to anything other than another church. We've already seen that in 1 Corinthians chapter 16 verses 1 through 4. And that, not for a work common to all, but to help out the church that's receiving the funds because they are in need. They're unable to take care of their own benevolent needs. 1 Corinthians chapter 16. We've already looked at that, so I'm not going to look at that again. Each major falling away, each major apostasy that results in a denomination in the last 2,000 years in the Lord's church, each began with a corruption of the organization of the church. The falling away that resulted in the Catholic Church in the West, the Orthodox Church in the East, came to a culmination in 606 AD when Boniface III proclaimed himself the universal bishop of the church, the head of the church on this earth, and he had the power to make it stick. Before that, other men made the claim they didn't have the power to make it stick. But Boniface III had the power to make it stick. And so the Catholic Church had its inception with the Pope in 606 AD. But those in the East didn't go along with that. They just had various patriarchs around different parts of the empire. And there was the Orthodox Church in the East and the Catholic Church in the West. But the falling away that led to that, and now there's so many differences between both the Orthodox and the Catholic and what the New Testament church is like. I don't know if I could begin to count the number of ways that they're different. But it began with the simple change of one elder being called the bishop in distinction to the other elders, a head elder over the other elders. That's how it began. Just that little simple thing. It seemed so innocent, but it wasn't innocent. It was the beginning. First of all, it was unscriptural. And second, it was the beginning of corruption of organization. The same thing happened in the 19th century, the formation of the Christian church, and the same thing happened in the 20th century with the division between institutional brethren and non-institutional brethren. It all began with a corruption of the organization of the church. And a simple illustration to this, you want to put up a window in your house. You want to put up a picture window. Well, if you put it up with just one big pane of glass, you can see better, can't you? Get a lot better view. But what if somebody throws a rock at that window? You're going to lose that whole window, aren't you? What if you then put some pieces of wood in between? I forgot what those are called. Boards?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. I knew that Victor would know. You put those in between and make separate window panes. And you can't see as well. Listen to me carefully. Autonomy is not as efficient as one big organization. You can't see as well if you have it all divided. But what if somebody chunks a rock at it? You're going to lose one little window pane, not the whole thing. And that is exactly the illustration, I believe, that gets across the difference between autonomy and being tied together in a giant church organization of any kind. If one congregation goes bad, starts teaching false doctrine, practicing things that are wrong, but every congregation is autonomous, how many congregations go bad? Just one. What if they're all tied together and one goes bad? What happens? They all go bad. That's the reason. That's the reason that every major falling away in the Lord's church began with a falling away in the organization of the church. So what we must do is maintain, determined to maintain the New Testament pattern for the organization of the church. Hold fast the pattern of sound words, Paul says, which you have heard from me in faith and love, which are in